Hey, this is Robin Miller, and you need more front wing and a little more vodka probably, too.
Welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wolcraft, joined as always by my co-editor Paul Dalby, and this week we are thrilled and honored to be joined by normally of SECA Trans Am fame, but this week also an analyst in the booth with the NBC Sports Network for the Izon IndyCar series, Tommy Kendall. Tommy, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me.
It was great to hear you in the booth this weekend. Did you enjoy your time there, and do you think it's something that you'd like to try again with IndyCar? I know you've done some work with Champ Car in the past.
Yeah, I very much enjoyed it. The NBC Sports Group is, at a pretty high level. The way they cover the races, they've got some great people. And, I've worked with Terry Lingner before and a number of the people behind the scenes. But it was fun to join the A team there and jump right in. I mean, Texas was a kind of a loaded event with a lot of stuff going on leading up to it. But I was happy to join, and I'll be in the booth in Iowa as well. I'm subbing for Wally Dallenbach in those two races.
Fantastic. Well, having been on the ground for Texas, let's pick your brain a little bit about exactly what the feeling was in the paddock. As an informed observer, what did you see, and what were your impressions of the attitudes and the emotions from within the paddock before and after the event? What was sort of the evolution of that as the weekend went on?
Well, I mean, it goes back to October, and everybody was so raw after Vegas, and here we are only 8 months later and going into the first race on a similar track. So most people were pretty cool, calm, and collected on the outside, but there was a lot of angst going into it, and which is why there was so much pressure to change the formula and break up the pack racing and so forth. And I live right near Oriol Servia, so spent a good bit of time with him, and he's been talking about Texas for a long time, and so there was a lot of subplots going on, but everyone navigated their way through it. The race came off not only without a hitch, but it was also a spectacular race.
It was. Did you hear anything directly from any of the drivers about what took place in some of the meetings that were behind closed doors and the decision-making process? Were they generally happy with the way that things went? Nobody really knew exactly how the car was going to drive until pretty well the race started. I mean, there were final changes were made right before the final practice session, if I remember correctly. So it was a little bit touch and go all weekend.
Yeah, that was actually kind of the funny part about it, because there was a lot of premeditation towards what they really wanted. And, the mantra was, we want to break up the packs. We want to put it back in the driver's hands. We want to make it so the cars are tough to drive. And I watched the first practice in the booth, and saw some huge slides. Dario Franchitti had one, and I'm sure a bunch of people had them, but Dario had one that we caught on tape, and Jerry Hildebrand also had a pretty good one that we caught on tape. And then I went down there immediately afterwards to talk to some of the guys, and they were all, whoa, 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 these cars are wild. We need some downforce. And so it was, we were kind of chuckling that, be careful what you wish for.
Right.
I think once everyone settled down, they realized they were probably pretty close, and it was pretty much what they had asked for. And so, that's why the tweaks were minor. They added that one little tiny, very small wicker bill. And it's kind of the nature of the beast. I don't care what the package is or what the race is. After every session, everybody except one person is usually not happy, and that's the fastest person. And the engineers, their job is to make the cars better. The driver's job is to make the car, and that's just wired into them. So it's, you kind of have to, and I think some of them kind of said that going into Texas, we're not going to race any different once the green flag drops. So you kind of need to save us from ourselves.
Right.
Tommy, one of the things, concerns going into the race, had been the talk about the fence, the SMI fence design. And you mentioned Oriel Servia, who's been one of the more outspoken critics of that. Now, I had a suspicion, it was confirmed by Jan Bikas and perhaps yourself as well during the broadcast, that showed a very good picture of that fence, of where the actual structural members of that fence are on the track side again. And it's just the debris stuff that's, you know, really nothing that's going to do anything to help or really hurt a car for that matter. When the driver saw that and kind of got back there and really had a chance to investigate that, did they continue to have those concerns through the weekend, or did they kind of cool down a little bit about the fence once they got back down there?
I don't think so, you know, because they were there testing and got to look at it then. But it just kind of shows how raw the nerves were after Vegas. And the reality is the fences are not good. You know, it doesn't matter. The NASCAR guys have shown it. When you get into the fence, they literally just rip the car apart. Mm-hmm. They're meant to keep the fans safe. And, you know, what they do to the drivers and the cars is sort of secondary. And so, I mean, it doesn't change the fact that there is a huge need to make the fences. And it's not just Texas. I mean, Indianapolis, tore Conway's car apart. You know, I suspect in the Tony Redd accident, that was a huge factor in that one being fatal. And so, I mean, it doesn't change the fact that fences need the same sort of quantum leap forward that the walls have gotten with the safer barrier. And so it doesn't take away from that, you know. So I don't think it really changed, you know. Oriel, I haven't talked to him specifically about it, you know, but he was focused on the fence being on the inside versus the outside. And I tend to kind of agree with Dr. Sicking, who, you know, said that it wouldn't make much difference at all. I tend to believe that. You know, I think the driver's view was, if it's 1% better, how can you not do it? Or 0.5% better. The reality is, you know, if you're SMI, you know, I don't know what the bill is to put a fence on the inside versus the outside. And once you do it there, you have to do it in every single one of your tracks. It's a huge number. So, you know, I see both sides of it. The reality is, fences really, you know, hopefully will get some attention. I'm guessing they are, but that's something that where the pressure needs to be kept up is, let's make these, you know, let's do the same kind of upgrade that we've done to the walls.
On the other hand, when you look at the incidents this weekend, you say, you know, if the fence makes 1% of a difference, then why don't we do it? And that's absolutely a fair point. But where the fence might make 1% of the difference, I think what could make, say, for example, 10% of the difference is making sure that the car stays on the ground to begin with. And that's one area where the DW12, although there had been some early concerns, really appeared to perform well this weekend. We didn't see a single car that I saw take any air in an incident, and that's something that's been an issue in IndyCar racing for a while now. So I know that that's something that Dallara is continually trying to improve on. There were some concerns in Indianapolis and some changes made. It seems as though they're going in the right direction. Certainly, we haven't seen anywhere near so far this year the type of catching air that we would have seen in the past with the previous car, and that seems to me like a more and I'm no expert, of course. I'd like to toss to TK to get his thoughts on it, but to me that seems like a more valuable and less expensive way to approach the problem. What do you think, TK?
Yeah, well, I mean, in production car, there's two types of safety measures: those that are meant to keep you out of accidents, and those that are meant to protect you once you're in them. And so, you know, I think those, what you're talking about, are some of the preventive. I mean, maybe not keep you out of the accident, but keep the car from getting up in the air once there is one. You know, I'm not even close to being ready to say that they've solved that issue, but you know, we saw this car launch Marco Andretti at Long Beach. So,
that was a very different type of incident, though. That was Marco catching the wheel in a really bizarre way on Graham's car, where he kind of nicked behind the wheel guard in the back. The sort of catching air that I'm talking about is where you would get cars that hit the wall and then they would just sort of spin upward for no apparent reason. We haven't seen very much of that kind of catching air this year, as opposed to we would have in the past. I mean, the the catching off the wheels, that's in open wheel cars, that's always going to be an issue. And I think that they're going in the right direction, but I don't know how much you can ever really do about that. But the cars sort of lifting on their own seems to be easier, or going a lot better than it was.
I tend to agree with Tommy though, Steph. I think that I don't know we have enough evidence yet to say that the lift problem is cured, because even with the old Dallara, the previous model, when we had the big air accidents, and that's a terrible word, but I think you know what I'm getting at there. All of those were multiple car accidents. You can think of Kenny Breck, you can think of Ryan Briscoe, you can think of course, the Vegas accident. Even when Buddy Rice kind of barrel rolled, or Dario Franchitti when he went at Michigan several years ago, all of those were multiple car accidents. I can't remember a single car accident where a car just hit the wall and took air.
I'm sure there were a couple of times that Dario ended up on his lid by himself.
Yeah, well, he either ran over Koski, or he ran over, I think it was actually Weldon's car, or his front wheel at Michigan. I don't recall a single car, other than, of course, where Mario took air when he hit the foam, and then Sam, I think, had the same incident that year or the next year at Indianapolis, where he hit foam and kind of took air. But all the other ones, as far as I can remember, were always multiple car, where one typically ended up climbing over the other, and the car didn't settle back down like Marco's did. So far, I don't know that we've seen any multiple car accidents except for the Power Conway accident in Indianapolis. And I think that one was when we saw Conway starting to get up, but I thought he was coming down before Will just happened to be at the exact wrong place at the exact wrong time to kind of pop him back up again. So, I agree with Tommy. I'm not so convinced that we can say without a doubt that the lift problem has been alleviated. It looks promising, but I wouldn't say that. What I am pleased with, though, and I've said this before, is this new Dallara, when the drivers lose the back end, I like, and TK will correct me if from a driver's perspective he doesn't agree, but I like that the car continues to rotate and typically gets all the way back around to its left side, where it's hitting more flush with the whole left side and dissipating a lot more energy than with the old car, where it kind of did the quarter spin and usually backed straight in with the very stiff rear end and caused all sorts of back issues. TK, from a driver standpoint, wouldn't you prefer to get all the way back around and hit flush on the side?
Yeah. Maybe not. I mean, again, you're kind of splitting hairs. Totally flush is usually a pretty good hit, but kind of a three-quarter would probably be ideal. Those are going to be different at every type of track also, based on the cornering speed, et cetera, how much room there is up to the wall. So there's so many variables in the mix. That just kind of underscores that you can't protect or again every eventuality. And so it's one of those things where I like that everybody's vigilant, and that's kind of the thing. Safety is a relative term with this type of racing. You're going as fast as you're going, and it's a different era. I mean, back 30 years ago, it was just kind of accepted that you were going to lose a handful of guys every year. Mm-hmm. Now, you lose one in 10 years, it's unacceptable. That's huge progress. And, I think just kind of keeping the pressure on, I'd like, a focus on safety, both on the cars and on the circuits themselves. And, and then I'm not alone in this. I'd like to see the speeds kind of come back. Townsend Bell is a big proponent of that. I think part of the appeal is going into new territory, speed-wise, like an Indy. It's interesting that, there's a lot of things that went into it in terms of the split, et cetera. But the fall off in interest also coincides with no new track records in Indianapolis. So, I'm sure it's probably not any one factor.
No, I have to agree with that. Well, let's talk about Justin Wilson. The big story of the weekend comes away with his first oval win in quite spectacular circumstances, and then gets slapped with a penalty, unfortunately, or the team does post race. We had the opportunity to speak with Justin Wilson and get his thoughts on his win and some of the thoughts about the penalty as well, and also look forward to the rest of his season. So let's give that a listen.
And now we're pleased to be joined by the winner of the Firestone 550 this past weekend at Texas Motor Speedway, Justin Wilson. Justin, thanks so much for giving us a few moments of your time today.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
So, I mean, a lot of people were thinking, getting the band back together with Dale Coyne and Bill Pappas, that you guys would come away with a win this year, but I don't think anybody would have picked Texas. Can you talk a little bit about your feelings and the team's feelings coming off this, I don't want to say unexpected victory, but maybe surprise victory is the right word.
Yeah, no, it was pretty special. And like you said, it was unexpected. You know, we kept our head down, we worked on it, and we just... all these races you go into, you think we've got a chance. You just have to make sure you don't make a mistake, and that was the plan on Saturday night at Texas. And you know, I think we knew early on we had a good car, and it just kept getting better as the night went on. So, got to thank everyone at Delco and Racing for their efforts. They persevered through some long hours this year and given us some great cars. So. We're over the moon. Don't have much time to celebrate yet.
No, that's
the,
right.
The schedule. But pretty relieved to have got that win in, and now we're focused on trying to do it again.
Right, absolutely. So what, I mean, you're not known as an oval guy. You've now sort of got the monkey off your back of being known as a road course and street course specialist. To what do you attribute that shift? Is there something in particular that's different this year that made you able to pull that win out? Do you think it's the combination of the team? Is it the new cars that work particularly well for you? Is it the aero package from this past weekend? What's the right mix?
Yeah. It's all of them. Being back with Dale Coyne Racing, got Bill Pappas as my engineer. It's also, you know, this new car levels the playing field, puts us all back on the same level. And then, you know, also just, you know, hard work. And I felt like I've understood what I was needing to do. It just struggled before when we're flat out, you know, trying to get the speed. And this new aero package has definitely helped that. It leveled the playing field and made it so you had to lift. At both ends of the track, you're having to lift to get through the corners, and you weren't just, you know, flat out. It's like being on a highway when someone drives past you in a faster car. There's not much you can do. Mm-hmm. That's what it was like before. Whereas now you got the corners, you can make up time, you can lose time, gain time, and, you know, it just opened it up and allowed the driver to be part of it. So, you know, it was great. I enjoyed it, and I think it made for a fun race.
Absolutely. Well, you've touched on being happy with the changes themselves that were made to the aero package. Were you happy with the process that the drivers went through with IndyCar, particularly with you as sort of the leader of the drivers' association, if you will? Were you happy with the back and forth? And there were a lot of changes made this weekend. Did you think that was all handled well?
Yeah, I think as well as could be. You know, the drivers got together and said, you know, we'd like it to be more of a driver's track than just being flat out in a pack. So we expressed that to IndyCar, and they were open to it and you know, came up with a great package. So, you know, there was a little bit of backwards and forwards until we knew we had the right package. But I think considering how difficult that job is, you know, trying to hit the nail on the head the first time is not easy. And I think for the first weekend, like I said, there was a couple of changes throughout the weekend just trying to get that fine-tuned, but they hit it spot on for the race.
Yeah, they sure, from this side, it certainly looked like they did. It's hard to get too far into discussing the weekend without bringing up the penalty that Dale Coyne Racing was served for that technical violation post-race. I've seen in the press that you were quoted as saying that it was unintentional. Of course, it's hard to believe that anyone within your group would make an intentional error like that. Do you want to just expand on that a little bit more and maybe talk about how that got missed and that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's obviously really frustrating that that happened. We built the cars with those pieces on, and I think the specs changed the following week because of constantly changing configurations, trying to get the right package there. And went through tech a few times, and they, picked up on one of the items, but not on the other. And it was a pretty obvious piece on top of the car, but we didn't, the guys working on my car didn't know it wasn't allowed, and tech missed it, even though it sat there on top of the car. So it's just one of those things that human error, and it got through. And some people thought that it helped, but I think judging by the fines that IndyCar gave us, it shows that they believe it didn't help, and we believe it didn't help. It's more of a drag reduction, so it reduces drag. And usually, when you 99% of the time, when you reduce drag, you reduce downforce. So a track when you're looking for grip, we felt it played no part of the race. In fact, it could have even hurt rather than helped. So we believe we won the race because we had a setup that was looked after the tires and gave us the best balance throughout the entire length of the stint, not just the first 5-10 laps. And we felt that was the key to that race. So it's frustrating. You kind of have to explain it, and you go through this whole process. Some people don't believe you, but it's just part of it. And mistakes happen. And I know we're keen to come back and try and get another win, just to prove everyone that was the case.
Right. Well, without harping on it, if you sit back and look at that situation objectively, and put yourself in the situation of looking at it as though another driver had won and served this penalty, would you be able to sit back and say, yes, I feel that penalty fits the situation, and yes, I do believe that, or would you be feeling pretty riled up if you saw another driver in this situation too?
Well, I think, you have to speak with the engineers and find out whether, I'm sure there's every team's got a different opinion on whether that piece helps, but yeah, I mean, there's been situations like that throughout the season that, and throughout racing's history of things going wrong on a car that you think, well, did that help them? So, I've definitely lost out on many occasions due to that. So, I don't really think that helps us win, and that's all I can really answer for.
Yeah, no, that makes perfect sense. So looking at the last few laps of the race, did you think that if Graham hadn't tagged the wall toward the end there, did you have enough to get a run on him before the end, or was that really the ceiling factor?
No, I thought with about 10 laps to go, I thought there's no way I'm going to catch him. And then with 5 laps to go, I thought, I might just get there. And that was what I was thinking. I was maybe just get to the back of his car, but I wouldn't get a chance to pass him. So when he hit the wall and basically handed it over, I was really surprised. But knew that was our opportunity to attack and get the lead and win this race.
Right. So there were a number of engines that were lost, Honda engines, at various points in the last week or so. Of yours was one of them. You'll be serving a 10-spot grid penalty after an unapproved engine change from the blown engine at the Iowa test. And there are 4 other Honda drivers that will be serving those penalties as well. Are there any concerns among the Honda teams and drivers coming out of that right now? Is anybody a little bit worried about the reliability of this version of the engine, or is it all sort of being looked at as happenstance?
Well, actually, there's quite a few Chevys as well. I witnessed Tony Kanaan and EJ Vizo switch engines, and also I saw Will Power blow up on racetracks. So,
oh, because we've seen Will Power mentioned, but I haven't heard about Kanaan and Vizo. That's interesting to know.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I saw them switch out engines in the garage. So, I think there's quite a few penalties. I think both manufacturers are pushing to the limit, and these things happen. So, you can never count against it happening in a race. You hope it doesn't happen, but so far we've been fortunate that that it hasn't happened to us in the race. So we just got to keep our heads down, and even if something goes wrong, there's nothing we can do about it. From a team's perspective, we just go out there and make sure we have the best race car and give ourselves the best chance of being at the front and trying to win.
Right. Let's look ahead a little bit. Have you had a chance to look over the rules for the heat races for qualifying in Iowa? And if you have, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I looked at them briefly, just discussing it with my engineers. And I think the heat race is a great idea. I think it's going to be really interesting, a lot of fun. And, it always seemed like qualifying didn't really mean a lot in Iowa. So I think it's great that we get to try something different. I'm looking forward to it. I also think that you might actually push qualifying forward to practice, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to be in the fast group to have a chance of racing in the top eight. And, that top eight is chosen from practice. So there's still going to be guys that go out there and practice trying to be as high up as they can so they get into that fast group. So, maybe that could be done better, but ultimately I think it's going to be interesting. We're just going to have to see how it all plays out, and I'm looking forward to it.
Great. One last question. You've no doubt heard that the China event has been dropped from the schedule for this year and that another event is going to have to fill it. Given the choice, hypothetically, between going back to Texas, a race that you just won, a track that you just won at, or possibly going to Road America, which would you choose?
Well, right now I choose go back to Texas for obvious reasons, having just won that. But I think I would love to see Road America back on the schedule. I think that's a great racetrack. So I don't know. There's lots of good racetracks out there that we could go to. I mean, someone else throughout Cleveland. The old race on the airport there. I think that was a lot of fun. There's so many good places where we could go. It's what's going to make the most sense to the series as a whole that we should do, and whatever that is, I don't know, but it's going to be interesting to learn.
Great. Well, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. Congratulations again, and I hope that you and the team can continue to find this success as the season carries on.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Take care.
Always great to get Justin's perspective on things, and he's always very candid and insightful, and we really appreciate hearing from him, and congratulate him absolutely on his first oval win, and hope that he and the Dale Coyne group continue to see success as the season carries on. So about that penalty, TK is probably the best person to give us some insight from an impartial point of view on exactly how much effect that part would have had on that car and on its drivability. Can you give us any insight on that, TK?
I haven't seen the sheets. Jan Mikas actually mentioned it, I think, in his little piece, his doctor, Professor V piece, in terms of how many counts of drag and how many counts of downforce. The one that kind of caught my eye was the violation on Ed Carpenter's car. They said it was a wicker violation. I'm mm-hmm. guessing it was too big a wicker. And when I heard that penalty being 5,000, I said, I'm pretty sure every car in the field would have happily paid $5,000.
Yeah.
I know Chip Ganassi would. He wrecked two cars getting loose. So, That jumped out at me. On the piece on Justin's car, it's not as clear cut how big an advantage that was. But the Ed Carpenter one, and again, I don't know how much bigger it was, but that's the penalty seemed awful slight to me.
Oh, I agree with that completely, and it's interesting too to look back on the race and think about the comment that I think came from the booth, actually, saying that Ed had asked his PR person to tweet that he was apologizing that the race was so boring. Do you think maybe he was bored because he was pedal to the metal? Maybe he had just a little bit too much downforce to make things interesting for him. But it's interesting for sure. I all of the penalties this past weekend did seem rather light. The question about Justin, though, is would it really have, with the way that the race played out, did it really make a difference? And you can look at it two ways. You can look at it that, you know, he was gaining on Graham, and it could be that the fact that Graham knew that Justin was gaining on him was just enough to play with his head to get him to make the mistake, and would Justin have been able to get that gain if he hadn't had the part? Or was Graham going to have, okay, let's call it what it is, was Graham going to choke anyway and hand Justin the win no matter what was going on with Justin's car? It's kind of hard to call. Either way, there's no question about the misfortune that befell Graham. And is it just age? Is it just his lack of experience? What do you think, guys?
You want to go first, Paul?
Sure. I hope it's just a consequence of the type of race we saw there. You know, he was, 30, somewhere between 32, 35 laps on those tires. That's what we've asked for. We've asked for, and the drivers have asked for, make these tires fall off. Make these tires, as they age, make the car harder to drive. And Graham's car, he was trying to nurse those tires. He was trying to, you know, you could see the arc of the turn. He was taking a very wide radius turn, not down on the white line, but way out by the wall, trying to baby those tires all the way. And, you know, I think the tires just gave out. They kept getting worse and worse and worse, and he just gave it a little bit too much, a little too much leash there. You know, I don't think it's to say he, okay, yeah, he probably did choke, but I mean, it's not like he, you know, just completely drove it straight into the wall head on. I mean, he only missed it by, you know, we're talking a matter of a foot probably. So will he learn from it next time? Probably. But I give it credit to, I think it was just that type of racing where the components, in this case the tires, are performing as the fans and the drivers have asked for. And it just caught him out in that circumstance. You know, I don't think he'll do it again. I would hope not, but, you know, I didn't think he would do it that time, to be honest with you.
I think you're being a little too nice, Paul, and I only say that because I don't think Graham was that nice to himself when he recapped it, you know, when he said that will haunt him forever. There was a, you know, that was pretty telling that he thought that if you did that 100 times, you shouldn't do that 100 times.
Right.
You know, the line was quite a bit higher in 1 and 2, but it was not that high in 3 and 4, at least the line he was running. You know, he seemed to really be running a much bigger radius in 1 and 2. I mean, let's face it, it's easy for anyone except him to criticize because, you know, but if it was easy, everyone would do it. You and I'd be doing it. So, you know, an understeer crash is a little different than an oversteer one, you know, and, you know, I think that's why Graham was so down on himself afterwards. But, you know, you do bring up a good point, you know, just about the penalty with Justin Wilson. I don't think it's why he was catching him, but, you know, you don't want to get into the position where when you're assessing violations, you're saying, did it make a difference? Because, you know, that you want to get out of that because then people start doing stuff. And why'd they do it? You know, I don't know. You know, but you don't want people to be able to argue afterwards. Well, it wasn't that big of an edge. Well, it's kind of like when you go in for a speeding ticket and you watch all the people get up in front of you and they say, well, I was going with the speed of traffic. So you're saying you were going too fast. Guilty, guilty, guilty. You know, it's either right or it's not. And that's why, you know, it's not cool when you have a car that, that doesn't pass tech afterwards. So, you know, and the penalty afterwards for a winning car to not pass tech, you know, for it to be $7,500, I thought sent the wrong message.
Well, you make several good points there. And the one that stands out to me is if you've got a winning car that's not passing tech, how is that in any case, because as we all know, discretion is a bad word, how is that not a disqualification? Period, outright. And I think the answer is, if you're, for example, if you're in France family land, I think they're explicit policy is that fans leave the track knowing who won the race, and that no penalty is ever going to change that result after the fact and get fans confused. Is that a worthy policy, or are we setting a bad precedent here? Because, I mean, several drivers have come up and said, hey, I'll gladly pay, you know, as TK pointed out earlier, I'll gladly pay 10 grand if it's going to win me a race. No problem. Is it enough? Is it enough to deter people from attempting to do this sort of thing this weekend?
My opinion, I think IndyCar, from a fan standpoint, IndyCar fans have always held themselves to a higher standard regarding the purity of a sport. You know, I think we as IndyCar fans often like to thumb our nose at NASCAR for their sometimes goofiness of not upholding the purity of their events, which includes basically allowing a team to cheat with an illegal car and win with an illegal car. And we've seen it time and time and time again in NASCAR. We haven't at least seen or heard of it as much in IndyCar. It could be, I'm not saying it didn't happen, but there's...
We haven't heard anything about penalties at all, Paul. This is a very new thing, so you have to keep that in mind too.
Right, and that's what I was getting at. So it could be a consequence of that. But, you know, I don't know that I'm ready to say that you need to wash Justin's victory away because of any infraction. I think there needs to be some sort of categorical bins of infractions. You know, if this is an infraction that gives him, you know, 3 or 4 extra miles per hour every lap, then yeah, that's something for sure. But if it's a wheel weight that exceeds whatever sort of spec or standard, or just some other goofy standard in the rule book that, you know, kind of gets lost in legalese, I don't want to take away a rule because, you know, by the letter of the law, his car number is a quarter of an inch too small on the rear wing. You know, I think there needs to be some sorts of technical bins of violations. But I agree, if this is the type of violation that gave him a true advantage during the race, then I, from a fan standpoint, I don't have any problem seeing that victory taken away from him. I don't.
Well, they took part of what NASCAR does, but not the other part. They took the one part that says the fans have a right to know who won, but the other part of NASCAR is they tend to lower the boom and make you kind of wish you hadn't done it. You know, it's even, you know, when you argue, well, it wasn't that big of an infraction, so the fine shouldn't be that great. They give unbelievable fines for infractions that you say that didn't seem like that big a deal. Their point is, the message they're trying to send is, don't do it. Don't do it. We're not trying to make this commensurate with the crime. We're trying to make it worse than the crime so you don't do crimes. You know, it's sort of the Singapore approach. I guess you could argue both ways on the, you know, do you have to do what NASCAR does? You certainly don't. But you certainly shouldn't take the part of theirs that doesn't make total sense to everyone, namely the winner is always the winner, and then follow it up with a fine that everybody says, God, I'd happily pay $5,000 for a wicker. I'd happily pay, you know, you want to make it so you kind of cringe and say, oh, wow. I bet you they wish they hadn't done that.
Mm-hmm. I think the fine for Justin was something like 10% of what the leader circle money was worth for this race or something like that. It was crazy. Before we move on, this is a sort of an aside, but Tommy, you made a comment earlier that I'd really like to explore in a little bit more detail. Just offhandedly, you said an understeer crash is different from an oversteer crash. Now, a layperson might not really know exactly what you mean by that. Can you explain from a driver's standpoint what the difference would be?
Well, okay. I mean, just in general, we should explain what the two types are.
And yeah.
In racing schools, when people are being funny, they say understeer means you crash with the front of the car and oversteer means you crash with the back of the car. Basically, it's the front sliding versus the back sliding. Understeer, the car is not turning as much as you would like it to. Understeering. Oversteering is it's turning more than you would like. Namely, the back is trying to pass the front. So, you know, an understeer crash, if you're up in the marbles, you know, it's your fate is kind of sealed the minute you get into the marbles. And marble, and you could see that with Graham on the replay. There was dirt flying off the right front. And so how much higher he was than normal, I don't know. You know, it's not really clear to see that. But bottom line, you know, if it's understeering, which he said his car was understeering quite a bit at that point, you know, you're going to probably not flirt with that. And the way, you know, generally to fix understeer is just you crack the throttle. You know, it's not as simple as that because they're really hauling through the corner, and generally different parts of the corner, it might be fine everywhere except you've got one little understeer spot, you know, so it's oversimplifying. But whereas an oversteer crash, when the back end jumps out, like with Dixon, it sounds like the cars were loose getting into three and loose coming off of four. And so chances are he was chasing it every lap, and then one lap he just couldn't catch it. He was down so low because he was trying to, you know, stay in some clean air behind, I think it was Jake's. And so he was right down near the apron. Once the car was sliding, the minute the tire, left front tire hit the apron, you know, it was kind of all over. So oversteer is just generally, you know, can be harder to catch. You know, an understeer crash is the end result is the same. A crash is a crash. But generally speaking, understeer is easier to deal with than oversteer.
Awesome. That's great insight that we don't always get to hear from this side of the fence. So thank you.
Before we get off that, Tommy, real quick, can you explain, as a fan watching it, can we tell by the racing line if a car is understeering or oversteering in general?
You usually can't tell just by the line. I mean, you can tell in car because, you know, a car that's understeering, their hands aren't going to be doing that nearly as much as a car that's neutral or that's oversteering. You know, if the hands are jumping around quite a bit, that's, you know, the car is either neutral or oversteering or free, sometimes they say. Mm-hmm. If it's understeering, you kind of got your hands in one position and you're modulating the throttle to give it however much the front tires will take, basically. But, you know, unless you can see the front tires just on a road course where you have more steering angle, you can see understeer and oversteer. Obviously, the rear of the car is sliding.
So on an oversteer, it's not quite as simple as saying high in, low apex, high out. It really is dependent more on the car setup itself. Then,
I mean, generally speaking, high in, low, and then high is going to be that's just maximizing the radius of the corner. So with any given setup, the less you turn the steering wheel, but theoretically, the higher speed you can maintain. Mm-hmm. Which is why you heard him talking about something like Will Power saying you really had to use all the road. You know, when they were limited before, they were running the inside and the car was never close to being at its limit. So they just basically tried to run the shortest distance around the track. The minute traction or, you know, how well the car would stick basically was a factor, they started, you know, using more road entering the corners and using more road exiting the corners. But you can't just tell by the line. And actually, different people I talk to, it depends. It's kind of setup dependent. I talked to Todd Malloy, Tagliani's crew chief, and you know, I was trying to figure out where, if you see a guy running up high, what is he dealing with? And it was different for different people. Some people said their car was looser up high. Some people said their car was tighter up high.
Okay.
Very interesting stuff. You mentioned Dixon earlier, Tommy, and that's actually the driver that we would like to talk about next. It really looked like for about two-thirds of this race, he was the class of the field. He was running away with the thing, and then he made a mistake. Dixon doesn't make mistakes. When was the last time we saw Scott Dixon make a mistake? 2009? Something like that? Crazy amount of time. I mean, I don't even really know what to say. Chip Ganassi, other than Graham, really was not a factor at all this weekend. And, I mean, we can talk about Dario and his struggles in a minute, but Dixon specifically, you have to look at that moment as season-defining. This could be the race that he looks back on at the end of the year and says, that's the one where I lost the title.
That's, yeah, it. Well, if I think if they get this kind of a package if it works out the same way in Milwaukee and works out the same way in Iowa if they, you know, nail it in all those ways. I think there's a lot of people that are going to be dealing with the same kinds of things. But it's totally, terribly uncommon. I mean, when was the last time you had two guys crash out of the lead? You had Dixon crash out of the lead, and then you had Graham crash out of the lead.
Mm-hmm.
You have Dario Franchitti, who's like an oval master, three-time Indy winner, and just, you know, chasing it, pitting under green to try to fix it, pitting again to have him disconnect his rear sway bar.
Which is crazy. I can't remember ever hearing about somebody doing that.
It used to happen back in the day at places like Milwaukee and places like Indy. You'd have guys, I remember some of the greater, you know, my favorite Indy 500s, you know, I want to say 91, when Mears started on the pole and then, you know, faded big time, worked on the car, you know, really was having trouble hanging on to it, and then came roaring back through. So, I mean, that's kind of how it works when you have this kind of racing where the driver is involved, and it's hard. You know, we've been sort of that's one of the consequences of the type of racing we had before. Not only was it dangerous, it really masked who was doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
Most all of the focus was on who can get drag and friction out of their car, you know, and that was sort of, and there, I mean, I don't want to, there was something to being able to get around a guy. You saw Weldon working the outside of guys on those kind of tracks. Hornish was unbelievable at it. So there was a knack for doing it. It's just not the same kind of knack we're used to, which is trying to balance the car on the limit of adhesion at wild speeds.
Right. It's a different breed of racing for sure. Paula, do you have anything you wanted to touch on with Dixon or Dario? I mean, Dario was just out to lunch this
weekend. Yeah, I actually think Dario was more surprising than Dixon. I mean, Dixon ran so well up until about two laps before he crashed, and you know, ultimately he just couldn't hang on to the loose car. But Dario was lost from the green flag. I think he started third, and I don't think he ever got above that, and he dropped pretty quickly right from the start. And yeah, you just don't see a driver of Franchitti's caliber come in after, I think it was something like 16, 18 laps to come into pit, because it's that bad and never got better. That was the other part. It never got better for him.
Well, no, because once he disconnected the rear sway bar, he was begging for more downforce. Then they disconnected the rear sway bar for him, and then it was so glued to the track he couldn't get any speed out of the thing. It's so bizarre not only to see him struggle, but also the target Chip Ganassi Racing Group, because this is a team that has resources to spare, usually. And, I mean, look at Dario's season. It's been – I can't recall. I mean, Tommy's probably – the guy who would be able to draw a parallel here, but I can't think of any driver who's ever had a season like doing abysmally poorly at the first four races. I think he finally sort of started to get his act together in Brazil, wins the Indy 500. He's finished second in Detroit, but Detroit really doesn't count because it was such a mess of a race to begin with. And then tanks it again in the next oval race at Texas. I mean, it's just the biggest roller coaster you've ever seen. It's so bizarre, especially from this group that's usually so tailored and so on top of their game. Tommy, any thoughts on that?
Well, I think, you know, it's with a brand new car, you know, having a slow start to the season isn't that surprising. He had a slow start last year. Actually, after the barber test, he totally killed me because I took him out of my fantasy team. And he gave me a big head fake, and then I should have known better. But then, you know, this year there was a perfectly good explanation. You know, until they got those pedals sorted so that he could right foot brake, he basically, you know, I think in Alabama, he cut one of the tests short. He just said, you know, this is pointless for me to try to drive this with my right foot, if I'm not going to race it this way, and I'm not. And so I think there was a little bit of a hole there, you know, and then just a new car, you would expect them to take a little while. At Texas, I'm not sure that we won't find out that there was maybe something wrong with Dario's car, a broken shock or something. Mm-hmm. Whenever you have something that doesn't make any sense, the culprit is often something like a broken shock. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. You know, one thing I do want to say about Dixon, and this came from Graham Rahal, saying, you know, I thought my car was loose, and it, the times he was around Dixon, he says his car was crazy loose. So, you know, it was all the more testament to Dixon that he was, you know, able to keep it out front for so long. And at the end of the day, it's just, you know, that's one thing they say about loose cars on ovals. Eventually, you're going to crash them. And so, you know, that's why Rick Mears fell back from that pole in 91. And had to work on the car. It's just one of those things you just kind of accept that, you know, you can't really charge with a car that's loose on oval. And so, and that's always been the big thing about Milwaukee is, and everybody knows it, so that's why they do the long runs and so forth. But if, you know, the tendency is 20 to 25 laps in, certain setups just go terribly loose and then you're just hanging on. And once that happens, it's like someone threw out the anchor and the car's going back in a hurry. So, you know, I think it sort of goes back to this DW12 is like a godsend. Nobody will say it, so I will. Part of the godsend is the fact that it's not great in certain regards. Mm. You know, the rear weight that they, you know, that was so disconcerting in all the early tests, they fixed by making new wishbones to, you know, to move the wheels back basically to get the weight shifted a little bit helped, but it's I think that's clearly why the car was so loose, you know, and so I hope they're not trying to fix it because that's actually what's behind these great races and why it's so hard to get a handle on this car. And it sort of was it's kind of the best accident ever, if you will. So it's you know it's a tough car to, you know, and you compare it to NASCAR. One of the best things about NASCAR cars that they can't take credit for is having a 22-gallon fuel cell behind the rear axle. So the weight distribution of that car changes through every fuel run. Mm-hmm. And you've also got kind of a massive aero to mechanical imbalance that are kind of opposite. And so that's why those cars are so hard to get a handle on. And now, just through some good fortune and so forth, we find ourselves with something kind of similar. And so the cars are really tough to find that sweet spot. And I'm wondering, the thought that crossed my head, seeing a big guy like Wilson win, you know, everybody bows up to the weight. But I'm wondering if having the big guy in the cockpit actually helps their weight distribution. I don't know.
That's an interesting thought. I hadn't even considered that. Yeah. Let's talk about the penalty to willpower. Does anybody disagree with it? I don't think we even need to broach that, right?
Nope.
So then we have to obviously give kudos to Bo Barfield for actually having the guts to make the call on the guy in the lead, because without wanting to be too inflammatory, and Paul has said it too, so I'm not alone on this. We don't think that this always would have been the case, that this call would have been made on the leader of the race. So good to see that the driver and the position is no longer a factor in having penalties applied, because obviously we like to see fairness and equality all around. What was interesting coming out of that incident, though, in particular, was Tony Kanaan's reaction, because when the front wing broke, his team had to tell him that it was broken. And as he was coming in to get the nose replaced for the second time in the race, by the way, because I think it was broken on an earlier pit stop, and they went through his spare and ended up putting a Barrichello's nose on it the second time. He was asking them as he came in, how did it break? He didn't seem to know that there had been contact between himself and Will. Tommy, from a driver's perspective, what does that tell you about the way that the DW12 operates, and what does that, both in terms of the way that the contact affects the front of the car and the effect that the front wing has on the handling of the car?
Well, it probably tells you that, you know, because they were so constrained on rear downforce that maybe the front being a little bit less efficient might have helped in a way. Now, I mean, sort of, not their insistence, their urgency in getting off the track. There's no question it was tied to the criticism they got after the Conway incident in Indy.
Yeah.
When they actually were trying to get him off the track and hadn't got him off the track when that crash happened. So, you know, it's, you know, I think it's hard to say. I mean, obviously it wasn't a lot of contact, you know, at those speeds though, the energy, you know, the forces involved are so much higher than they are some of the other places. You know, we saw at Detroit, you know, they would take a pretty good amount of beating and the wing would still be intact. But you know, the forces on at those kinds of speeds are so much higher. Everything's just exaggerated. The Townsend Bell was telling a story about, you know, the airflow over the car at those speeds. He said, if you stick your hand up at all, you know, he tried to make a little, he tried to wipe his little windscreen at Indy and the wind caught his hand. And next thing you know, it was behind his head. So, you know, you think about it, you stick your hand out the window on the interstate at 60 and then try multiplying that times, you know, almost four times and you get an idea. And that actually kind of underscores some of the penalties. You're like, well, how big of a difference could it have made? Well, you know, the forces are big at those speeds.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit now about the scheduling announcements that have come out, mostly today. Today as of recording, yesterday as of when you're listening to this. Two big stories today, the first one being that the China race is no more. This is one that's been coming for a while. What it means for the series, nobody seems to know exactly for sure. We know it means there's a whole lot of money that they're not getting. We know it means that the August schedule for the teams has gotten a little bit easier. I think there was a one-week turnaround between China and Sonoma, wasn't there, before this? So that's got to have a few people breathing a sigh of relief. But obviously that also means that that IndyCar needs to fill an event to reach their minimum of a 16 race schedule for several of their sponsorship contracts. So thus begins the speculation on what the extra event will be. I was doing some reading today and found that although there's been a whole lot of speculation, we mentioned this on last week's show about Road America and that weekend being open in August with the ALMS, Randy Menard is not actually apparently permitted to speak to Road America until after the Milwaukee event this weekend because of, I can't remember exactly what the term was. It might have been a conflict of interest, but I don't feel like it was that, or a non-competition agreement or something to that effect. And so it could be that that's one of the ideas that's on their radar, but no discussion has started on that as of yet. Of course, the bigger story that came out today was the fact that it was revealed by the team at Texas Motor Speedway that Eddie Gossage has been approached by the series about the possibility of having a second Texas race as the season finale for this year. Obviously, coming off a hugely successful weekend, that probably has a lot of people excited in the Texas area who wouldn't mind seeing another race like the one that happened this weekend. But it's got to be creating some concerns in California with Auto Club Speedway, who up until probably 3 or 4 days ago were under the impression that they were going to have the season finale and were making plans to that effect. And I know that I've seen some people say, well, I bought plane tickets and race tickets to see a season finale in Los Angeles. So now what? So interesting to see the fallout from several angles here of what the potential could be. Do you guys have opinions on what your preference would be, or if there are any other stories out there that I haven't mentioned that you're hearing possibilities of? TK, why don't you go first?
Well, I'm like everybody. I would love to see them go to Elkhart Lake. It's my favorite track in the world. And that was a lot of that opinion was formed going to the, you know, the Trans Am IndyCar or Champ Car, whatever it was then, double headers. And so, I mean, it's just a spectacular venue. Whatever they do, they've got to do it quickly. I mean, that whole thing, it would be ironic if they, I mean, not only they're totally playing high stakes brinksmanship in the press about whether we're going back to Texas next year. now we're going to rush back there. Racing makes strange bedfellows, and a successful race is a successful race, and Texas certainly was one. Eddie Gossage, you know, deserves a lot of credit for the guy who knows how to promote. That whole group knows how to promote, but he's been in the business a long time on a bunch of different areas, not always as a track promoter. When I met him, he was with Miller Brewing Company a long time, and so he knows it from the sponsor side, and he loves IndyCar racing. It'd be ironic if he gets a season finale when his primary gripe has been that he can't get the race right after Indy, and the way he would get the season finale is snagging it from another promoter. It'll be interesting to see how that, there's a lot, I'm sure Randy Menard's dosing on the Excedrin right now because he's got some headaches.
There's a NASCAR event in early November there, isn't there, at Texas? Don't they?
Yes. So
that would be an awfully tight in terms of scheduling for them, I would think. And they would have to do some analysis of how saturated their market would be at that time of year, because I don't believe they would have had that same issue when they were running late season races at Texas back in the IRL years. Paul, do you recall whether that was the case?
Yeah, Texas didn't get their second race until, I don't know, 07, 08. I think it was after the second. Well, maybe it was. They last ran the second IRL race there in 05, because I'm pretty sure that was the last Chevrolet and Toyota's last race was there. So would have been right after that that they got their second. I don't think they ever ran a second IRL race there when they had the Fall Cup race there. So that would definitely be a new challenge that they would have to overcome if they were going to go that route. Interestingly, the very first time I heard anything, and granted I was on the road traveling today, but the first time I heard anything about the possibility of them going back there was in the Texas Motor Speedway release that was titled, let me see here, Gossage makes statement regarding possibly hosting it. So, it kind of read like there were these rumors that Eddie was responding to. And the first thing rumor I heard about it came from Eddie himself.
No, I did see at least Jenna Fryer talking about it earlier today. I think that his response, Eddie's response, was very swift in terms of at least getting some kind of a statement out there, which was nice to see. But I did see some talk about it swirling earlier today. So it wasn't completely out of nowhere or completely out of Eddie Gossage's mouth. So at any rate.
I just think it's going to be a hard sell, whether it's if you can try to fit something into China's date in mid-August or if you go until October. Or when is the actual California race? Is it in September?
I think it's late September. Yeah.
Okay, so you would be looking probably at October if you go late in the season. I mean, do you want your season finale to be run in front of a crowd that's known of the race for less than, you're talking 4 months now?
Or do you want to have your season finale in front of the 16 people that are going to show up to Auto Club Speedway?
True. I'll give you that.
It's not exactly a well-attended venue. Sorry, TK.
No, I agree. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why it would make sense doing it at Texas. But you're going to have a really unhappy promoter in California. Mm-hmm. And but I guess, one domino falls and the other ones have to, going to somewhere like Elkhart, I don't know if that's possible because you don't have the option of doing that too late in the year because of where it is weather-wise. Mm-hmm. So it's safe to say they're a bit of a scramble, and any solution they come up with will probably not be perfect.
And which, by the way, Randy needs to treat California maybe with a little bit of kid gloves here, because remember that California race, not only is it currently the season finale, but it's also a rekindling of some small relationship with ISC, which has been dead for the last couple of years. if IndyCar has hopes of going back to Phoenix or Richmond or Michigan, starting off on a bad foot with ISC by taking away one of those promotional activities of California may not be the best way to grow that relationship, which is still probably tenuous at some point or at some level. Taking away their promotional activities for the season finale this year wouldn't necessarily be a great way to foster goodwill with that corporation overall, I don't think.
That said, there's no way that they would even be able to entertain this idea if there wasn't some kind of clause in their contract with Auto Club saying, we don't guarantee that you're going to be the season finale.
Yeah, but, I mean, I'm taking it as a given that they can do it. But just because you can do it doesn't mean, like Paul's saying, it's a great idea.
No.
You know, the reality is you could also, and this would lessen Eddie's motivation considerably, but if you say, listen, we're going to go back for a second Texas race, but it's going to be on the California date as it is now, and then we're going to slide California 2 weeks later.
Can you do that, though? Because you've got, again, people who've booked plane tickets. You've got people who've bought race tickets. I did read somewhere that they've actually, as much as we joke about the 16 people that are going to be there, they have sold some seats for this event. And picking it up and moving it even 2 weeks is a bit of an undertaking, and it might sour some people on the event enough that they just don't bother to rebook and still go.
Well, hopefully I'm guessing if they bought tickets, they're fans. So hopefully it's handled in such a way that you sort of wrap your arms around them and say, listen, we didn't want to do this. But this is the reality. And it was a choice between you coming to a race that is no longer the season finale or moving it 2 weeks later. We chose the lesser of two evils. We're willing to work with people, blah, 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 blah. So, you know, again, there's no probably super clean solution to all this.
Yeah, well, that's the ultimate statement about it, isn't there? It's that if this mess, it's a shame that there's this mess to deal with to begin with.
Let me ask you, both of you guys, from this question. Is it more important to go to somewhere like Road America, open up this opportunity where you really hopefully could get a spot on that calendar, or to look at an oval where you can try to shift some of this balance back? You're taking away a road course in season and shifting it to an oval. Is that a big consideration, or should that be a consideration for Randy and his people at this point?
Well, my thought is I think Randy, you know, as much as he may be contractually bound to do so, I think he's very wise to wait until after Milwaukee to really broach the issue anyway, because that'll give him an opportunity to see how well the Milwaukee race is doing. If it has a really poor turnout again this year, and there really doesn't look like there's any hope of rekindling the event, if it you know, as much as we all hope it doesn't happen, if it becomes obvious that we have to let it go, then yes, absolutely, he should be knocking on Road America's door, trying to get his foot in there and see if he can get something reestablished, because there's not going to be any concerns over saturating the Milwaukee and area, the Wisconsin market. If Milwaukee does do well, then he gets the concern of, can that market support two races? I know that there's been a lot of talk about not wanting to have too many events in the Midwest. There are a lot of markets that are being completely unserved or underserved right now that could certainly be looked at before Wisconsin can really justify having two events. And picking between Milwaukee and Road America, gosh, unless it becomes obvious after this weekend, that's a really tough choice to have to make. In terms of whether it needs to be an oval that's added, I think if you're talking about anywhere other than Road America, you might have a point. But I know very few people that would have an issue with a return to Road America, because it's just so iconic. And it's a track that, in ideals, it circumstances should absolutely be on the schedule in the first place. It's almost a crime that it's not there. It's just the issue of, can IndyCar's fan base support the mile and Road America? And a lot of those questions will be answered after this weekend, I think. Tommy, did you want to add anything?
No, I mean, they used to support both of them. You know, like you said, this weekend will be very telling.
Yeah, I think that's I think that that's the time to talk about it, is after this weekend when we can really see what Andretti Sports Marketing has done with the thing. And that being said, this is a great segue into previewing this coming weekend. Andretti Sports Marketing has done a bang-up job. And if the effort that they put into this isn't enough to rescue this race, then I'm not sure it can really be rescued. If you just even take a look at their website and some of the different things that they're offering to fans this weekend, there's that big Smash Mouth concert after the event. They're really turning it into an event. The way that people are always saying that road course events, particularly street course events are, and what makes them so successful, is because there's racing and it's the cornerstone of the event, but there's also other fun stuff for people to do. And I have to confess, I'm not super familiar with where the suites have been in the past, but it looked to me from glancing at the track map like they've found a way to work some more corporate suites in, which I know was a concern for being short on revenue stream in the past. It looks on the surface as though they've really done everything that they can do to make this event viable. The answer is going to be, are the butts in the seats on Saturday? And that's really going to be the crux of what decides the event's fate. I'm fairly confident. So we just have to kind of wait it out and see. From the racing perspective, if we're going to talk about Milwaukee, let's talk about those ubiquitous 10 spot penalties on the starting grid. We know of, as of now, 6 that are going to be served this weekend. 5 of them are Hondas. Let me just run through the list quickly. We've got Dixon, Conway, Sato, Wilson, and Newgarden have all had engine changes in the last week or so. Sato's and Newgarden's came at Texas, I believe, although one of those might have been, was it Dixon or Newgarden that didn't put the Gen 1 engine into their car after the Gen 2 engine broke, and so they're serving an extra penalty? That might have been Newgarden. Sorry, I didn't explain that well. There was the practice and qualifying engine at Indy that was the first generation Honda, and then the race engine at Indy was the Generation 2. Newgarden's Generation 2 engine quit, and then what the teams were supposed to do was put the Generation 1 engine back in the car and use that one up before they went to a new Generation 2 engine. A couple of teams, I think, actually opted not to do that and went straight to a new Gen 2, and so they had to serve 2 penalties for engine changes, and I believe that some of those are being served this weekend. Sorry, TK, were you going to jump in there?
Yeah, I was going to say it was kind of a double penalty. I know Sato's was a double. He had one he had to serve there and one at Milwaukee from the same change for exactly the reason you just said. And I'm not clear on Newgarden and the rest.
I think I'm pretty sure there were 2, and I believe the other one was Newgarden, although I hate not having my facts exactly straight when I'm talking live, but off the top of my head, I'm pretty sure it was. Wilson blew an engine at Iowa, and so did Dixon and Power at the test this week, and Conway as well, I think. That's where that other one came from. So if you're
now,
Honda,
now with Dixon, he had the engine he had at Iowa was new because of the crash at Texas.
That's right. Does a crash in the race count
as an approved? Is that an approved engine change?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have the double penalty then?
No, he just has a penalty for the one they lost at the test. Any other time but the race, if you have to change an engine, it counts as a penalty. But if you lose a race, or if you lose an engine during the race for any reason, that is an approved engine change. You're fine.
Clear as mud.
So, right, back to the fact that we have 5 Hondas and 1 Chevy in this list of penalties. If we're Honda, are we worried, guys?
I think so. I mean, because you're starting to bump up against the season long, you're allowed 5 engines for the season. And so you got some guys that are getting sort of well behind the curve.
Dixon in particular.
And so they're going to start incurring late in the year additional 10 position changes. So,
well, if everybody starts just accumulating penalties, then we'll just end up having the starting grids of the same alignment that we had to begin with, won't we? If we get enough people.
I was joking about, you know, because I'm a little new on the scene and not totally clear with all of some of that minutia. You know, when I saw Newgarden, his expire in practice, I was thinking, if there's a new spec coming every week and they're as big a change as the one was for Honda at Indy, I'd take a 10 position penalty every race to get my hands on the new good stuff. So, but I've been told that's not the case.
Well, I think it is for Lotus, but that's a different situation completely. I think they've explicitly said that that's what they're doing, aren't they? Because they're qualifying so far back anyway. It's all hardly a penalty. So every time a change comes down the pike, I think they're just saying, okay, we'll take the hit. We'll try the change and see what happens.
Hey, they did out-qualify J.R. Hildebrand last weekend.
Oh, don't mention that to J.R. I don't think you'll hurt his feelings. So, let's talk about picks for the win for Milwaukee. Who you guys got? Paul, you want to go first?
Oh, put me on the spot first?
Yeah. We'll be nice to Tommy, our guest, and let him have a minute to think about it.
I don't think Honda's going to have as much of an advantage this week. I don't think they're going to get to stretch their legs quite as much as they did at Indianapolis and Texas. I like the Penske guys coming back here, and I think Briscoe's going to get it done here again. Repeat from his, 2008 win, I think.
Right.
Yeah. So, yep, I'll take Briscoe.
TK?
Boy. I mean, these races are such a crapshoot now. I'm going to go with Hunter Ray, who is one of the few people to have led every single lap of an event at Milwaukee.
Yeah, that's interesting because I was going to pick one driver, and then I just had in my head, maybe I should pick Hunter Ray for the exact same reason. So now that you've picked Hunter Ray, I'm going to backpedal again. I'm going to go back to TK, the other TK, Tony Kanaan.
TK2.
Yeah, who has also gotten it done several times at this track, and he's due. And he does very well on these short ovals. They're very much his he's at home here. He likes this driving style, and provided his car cooperates, which, as we know, with the Chevys, has not always been the case this season. But provided that it does, I think he has a very good shot at getting it done this weekend.
So we all like Chevrolet this weekend, huh?
So it would seem. Well, just talking about the five penalties for Honda, it's hard to pick them, isn't it?
Yeah. You asked me how much I'd be willing to bet on it.
Yeah. No, that's right. On the other hand, if you put that amount of money down on Wilson last weekend, you came away with a heck of a lot of money. So, might be worth
true
the
story. I gotta say, between Dale Coyne and Justin Wilson, their post-race, you know, whatever expressions, you would have thought they were the ones that had 200 wins. Instead of Rick Hendrick or, you know, I wanted to shake him. I mean, I guess that's them. But there certainly wasn't the kind of emotion I was expecting out of Justin, a guy who, you know, who doesn't say boo if he has a mouthful of it, you know, broke his damn back by running off the road, not even crashing, comes back. I mean, there's so many reasons why that had to have been. And obviously he was happy about it. He just has a different, he's just stiff upper lip, I guess, Brit way of you know, not being too expressive. But I got an odd kick out of how reserved both of them were.
Well, that being said, he did do the burnouts on the front straight. He gave him that at least. You don't see that very often anymore.
And then he blew his engine in practice, in testing.
Yeah. That's a good point. Yeah.
I remember thinking that when he did that. I think, wow, you know, when you got these mileage limits on and, you know, you sit there on the hard limiter for the better part of 10 or 15 seconds, it can't be good.
I hadn't even considered that.
We may not see those burnouts as much.
But it's so nice to see a guy actually care when he's.
Oh, come on. It is so tried and old. When did Alex start that? 97?
Yeah, but
come on.
I'll take that over pull into victory lane, wait for the cameras to start up, and then jump out of your car and kind of do a couple of weeks.
Now that I do hate. The choreographed victory lane has got to go.
Yeah, you told me you were going to do a bit of a rant on that, and you haven't done it yet. You probably should get that done.
I know. trust me, there's a lot of rant still there. I got plenty of where that came from.
Well, on that note, I think it's a good time to call it a day. TK, thank you so much. It was really great to get some driver side insight from you, but also just insight in general on the inner workings, and it was great stuff that we got from you this week. So thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us, and we'd love to have you back anytime.
Thanks for having me. I got to be on my A game. You guys are switched on, so I gotta be sharp.
Well, thank you. That's high praise coming from you, and we look forward to hearing you back in the booth with NBC Sports Network in Iowa.
All right, we'll see you in a couple weeks.
Okay, and, from Paul and I both, thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week, of course, to review the Milwaukee Indy Fest and preview the Iowa Corn 250. And remember, when you need IndyCar news and views, get a grip with More Front Wing.